May it please the court, and I will reserve three minutes for rebuttal if that is okay with the court.
Okay, keep your eye on the clock. We'll try to help. It counts down.
This case involves a claim for benefits due under ERISA Section 502A1B, which says that a participant can recover benefits due, quote, under the terms of the plan. Plaintiff United Air Ambulance transported a minor child despite the child's own treating physicians saying the transport was against medical advice. Indeed, plaintiff, in their briefing, described the condition that the child presented with that day as a, quote, major source of mortality. And the independent external reviewer who looked at the case described the condition as emergent and life-threatening. Reasonably and rationally, the Cerner Health Plan does not cover services when they are provided against medical advice of the patient's own treating physician.
So could I ask about this? So as I read the plan language, it seems that it doesn't pay. There's a double negative. It doesn't pay for a service that is not recommended. So that sounds like when you add the two negatives together, it does pay for a service that is recommended. There's nothing that says a single doctor recommending against precludes a claim. It just seems to require a recommendation. And here, there were recommendations to do this flight. There were also recommendations not to. But I have trouble seeing how this condition isn't satisfied.
Well, Your Honor, I would disagree that this particular flight was recommended by any physician at all. The opinions on which United Air Ambulance relies are opinions from almost a month before the patient presented at the emergency room that day with what was an emergency situation. And indeed, those opinions from those physicians describe the child as stable and safe to travel at that time. But his condition changed when he presented.
Still have the condition that they thought needed a flight to Boston, though. Correct.
That those physicians from a month earlier. Yes, that is correct, Your Honor.
So you have the additional emergency argument, but I have trouble seeing how what in the plan tells us that the recommendation to fly to Boston had to happen that very day.
I think that first of all, as you know, on ERISA benefits cases, a plan gets deferent on their decision, and that there's only an abuse of discretion if the evidence is not reasonable. I'm sorry. It's only if it relies on a clearly erroneous finding of fact. And the way that they read the medical evidence was that it's true that those physicians a month ago said that the underlying condition that the child should be transported. And if United Air Ambulance or the participant had appealed that decision, we would have a different case. But then a month later, the condition changes. No one's health is static. It doesn't stay the same. And on the day that the actual transport happened, there was a life-threatening situation. And the treating physicians that day said, this child should not travel today, and yet he traveled. So I think that's the difference here. As I
look at the doctors in Phoenix who said this child shouldn't travel because of the sepsis, as I read that, it was the child doesn't need to go to Boston for that. We can handle it here. He was treated that day for the sepsis. There was some improvement in the condition before he actually got on the airplane. So I'm a little unsure that the recommendation of the doctors in Phoenix was it is too dangerous for him to fly, rather than the sepsis, which creates the sort of on-the-spot today emergency, is something that we're perfectly capable of treating, which I think was absolutely true. They were perfectly capable of treating that.
That's correct. I don't read
What part of that is correct? Because if you agree that everything I said is correct, that doesn't help you.
that is correct, Your Honor. The part that I agree with is that Phoenix Children's Hospital was certainly capable of treating the emergent condition that arose that day. And that's the important point. I don't read the medical records to say that he had been treated and then improved and had basically been released for transfer at that point.
I wasn't saying that. But what I was saying, I'm inclined to read the Phoenix doctors as saying, we can treat this. and therefore you don't need to go to Boston. I'm not sure I read them as saying you are threatening your child's life if you take that child to Boston today.
Well, the medical records are very clear that the transfer was against medical advice. In fact, the records use that very phrase. Yeah,
well, the question is, what precisely is the medical advice?
The medical advice was to be admitted and treated at Phoenix Children's Hospital, yeah, and not to do the transport. The records talk about how there were discussions about, we want to transfer him to Boston Children's Hospital, and the doctor said, you shouldn't do that. The stuff about how it was a life-threatening condition, that comes from plaintiff's brief, that he presented with a very serious condition that day. And also the independent external reviewer who looked at those same medical records described the situation as emergent and life-threatening. And so that's where that language comes from.
But Mr. Leopold, emergent and life-threatening from what condition? From short bowel syndrome or from sepsis?
I think it was from the sepsis.
I think so too.
Yeah, sure.
If the patient had been admitted to Phoenix Children's Hospital, treated for sepsis, and then it improved, and then the child very likely, and I'm no medical professional, I don't know how long, but days or several days, may have been released, and we have a different case, but that's not what happened here.
I'm still troubled by the fact that I don't see anything in the plan that says you may not get reimbursed for something that is against medical advice. I don't read the plan as saying that.
Well, Your Honor, there are two sections at issue. Services, the first is the definition of covered services, and this is the one that relates specifically to air ambulance transport. And it says there are two scenarios under which air ambulance transport are allowed. The first is does not have the required services and or facilities to treat the participant. And the interpretation of the medical evidence that the plan took was that the Phoenix Children's Hospital doctors were saying, we have the facilities to treat this. He needs to be treated here. And we recommend that he be treated here and not travel.
Okay, the second was the against medical advice point. I mean, that if all you're saying is we can treat him, there's another side of that, which is that they had also said Boston needs to treat him. So I don't think saying we can treat him is the same point you were trying to make, as I understood it, about against medical advice.
Right. Well, the covered services language says that the participant needs to require transport for treatment for the condition. And the condition that the child was in, the total condition of the plaintiff that day, both the underlying condition and the emergent condition, did not require transport. Phoenix Children's Hospital was capable, and in fact, the treating physicians recommended that he be treated there. And the plan was following the medical advice of the patient's own treating physicians in interpreting that. And then the second part of that is that the participant has an unstable condition that requires medical transport and rapid transport. And again, the treating physicians did not think that it required medical transport, rapid transport. They thought that he required to be admitted to Phoenix Children's Hospital. That was the opinion of the treating physicians.
Before your time runs too much, assume that we don't have sepsis. I understand that that's counterfactual. But assume that what we have is short bowel syndrome. Phoenix cannot treat it. Boston can treat it. Is it your position that even though medical transport in that child's condition could really safely be done only by air ambulance, so there's no contest that it can't be treated in Phoenix, no contest but what Boston can, and no contest that the only safe way to transport him is by air ambulance, it's your position that nonetheless air ambulance is not covered under the plan?
Your Honor, if there was no sepsis, we have a different case.
I understand that, and I'm asking you that question. What's your answer to the different case?
Yes, my answer is that if there was that different case, that claim would have been gone through the administrative process, and we don't know how that would have come out. it could have turned out exactly as you say, that it was uncontested, that he needed the transport and that it should be covered. But that question was never examined by the administrative process, because we were dealing with a child who had the underlying condition, yes, but also had sepsis that day. And his own treating physician said he should not travel.
So your argument is not based upon the fact that it would not be covered if we didn't have the sepsis. You're saying that simply hasn't been decided?
That's correct. There was a claim filed in February when they submitted those medical evidence, those medical opinions in February, but it was never pursued through appeal. It was dropped. And then it was about a month later, he appears at the emergency room, and then they take the transport that day and do a claim based on that day's situation.
So I just want to make sure I understand this exchange you've just had. In your brief, you argued that one of the reasons this claim was properly denied was that there was no emergency presented by the short bowel syndrome. It sounds like you're backing away from that and saying we don't know whether it would have been covered. Am I understanding that correctly? You're not relying on the emergency point anymore?
Well, no, Your Honor. They certainly said that in the decisions. But what I'm saying is that factual development was not gone through and was not fully examined, because that wasn't the claim that was before them.
So we should not use the emergency basis. The air transport requires an emergency in your argument in your brief. You're not relying on that anymore as a basis to justify the denial.
Well, Your Honor, when he presented at the emergency room on that day, there's no doubt that it was an emergency situation. I think that the emergency situation is a red herring, because that's not the reason that they denied the claim when he showed up at the emergency room. That was the original reason that they denied the first claim, was that the underlying condition was not an emergency, but that was never pursued through appeal and wasn't developed by the administrative process.
Yeah, I actually agree with you about that, because the September 13th denial only talks about services must be recommended by the medical provider. It doesn't say anything about emergency.
I think that's right.
I was going to ask you about that, but it sounds like you're not trying to add the emergency reason at this point anyway.
No, I mean, when he shows up at the emergency room, it's clearly an emergency. I don't think anybody disputes that. I also want to point out just the independent expert.
It's an emergency as to the sepsis, not as to the short bowel syndrome.
It's an emergency situation on March 21st when the transport happened. But the earlier claim, the underlying situation, they denied that, saying it was not an emergency situation. That claim was never appealed. It never gets developed through the administrative process. It's a non-issue as far as whether this claim for his condition on March 21st is covered.
Well, we're threatening to take you over time, but there's enough complexity here that don't worry about the time. We'll make sure that you get to make your argument now, and we'll have time for rebuttal. So don't be too nervous about the time here. My understanding is that there are two levels of application. The first one is the pre-authorization review. And because the pre-authorization review and then the appeals from that doesn't necessarily finish before the event happens, so pre-authorization is an odd thing. But at the end of the pre-authorization appeals, it looks as though this was approved, although with the caveat that, well, wait a minute, we may give you a different answer when it's a claim. But am I mistaken that when you get to the top level of pre-authorization review, that it was approved? I thought it was.
Your Honor, pre-authorization is a unique process. It's not.
But that's not my question. Was it approved at the end of the pre-authorization appeal process?
Not under the terms of the plan, no.
But it was approved. I mean, you might say that doesn't count as guaranteeing payment, but the pre-authorization process ended with something saying this is medically necessary.
Yes, it did say that it was medically necessary. That's correct. But it also said that it was subject to all terms and conditions of the plan. And so it decided that one particular unique issue, which...
Is there anything better that can come from the pre-authorization process?
I think the pre-authorization process is more useful when it actually plays out pre-service. So... There's only one circumstance under which the plan requires pre-authorization, and it's for elective inpatient procedures and I think transplant services or something. And so in those circumstances, you'll always get an answer before the service is actually provided or before the inpatient stay happens, in which case it would be very, you know.
And do those also have this language, though, this doesn't guarantee payment that was in the pre-authorization language here?
I don't know what's in those letters. I've never seen one of those letters. The denial letter here is the only one I have. I don't know. I would think that it would be very hard if you pre-authorized a claim pre-service and then a participant acts on that advice and then you go back and deny the claim. That's a very different case than what happened here, where no one relied on this pre-authorization. It came 4 months later.
I don't understand why there even was a process that was called pre-authorization that went past when the service was given. Can you explain that?
The plans typically offer this pre-authorization services as sort of a service to their participants so they can get an idea of whether things are covered. And it's unique that this pre-authorization request gets appealed and gets decided 4 months later. That's very unique and very unusual. I agree. And I don't have an explanation for why that went on. Months later.
At this point, maybe we'll hear from the other side. You sought to reserve 3 minutes. We'll give you 3 minutes in rebuttal. We'll make sure everybody gets a chance to say what they need to say.
I appreciate it, Your Honor. Yeah.
Mr. Buntrick.
You got your...
You're muted.
You're muted. Now better.
Okay. Can you hear me okay?
There we are.
All right. Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Shane Buntrock. I'm here on behalf of United Air Ambulance, who is here on behalf of KM, who was at the time a two-year-old child at the time of this flight. A benefit was provided by United Air Ambulance. I just want to, and I appreciate the questions that I've heard to the appellant's case, and I want to emphasize some of those. I want to just start, though, if I may, with I think three things here. Number one is just this overarching remedial nature of ERISA legislation that isn't new to this court, of course, but it's just a reminder of what the purpose of ERISA is, and it's to protect participants. In this case, it's to protect KM. And I don't think we can lose sight of that. And the reason that factors into the other overriding principle, and I think why the district court found as it did, and why I think the conclusion that Cerner definitely abused its discretion in denying this benefit, was because all circumstances need to be considered here. We do not, ERISA does not require, this plan doesn't require, and Judge Friedland, you pointed out, you know, where does it say in the plan that there's a time limit on a provider's recommendation for treatment? There isn't. Where does it say in the plan that just because the mother, who obviously, this KM, by the way, was a premature infant, and so unique circumstances here, of course, but the mother, in conjunction with the medical providers, in conjunction with United Air Ambulance, determined that this child needed to get to Boston, okay? And she made that decision. Just because one doctor thought it wasn't a good idea at Phoenix Children's Hospital doesn't negate the ability to pay for benefits for the flight. It's interesting about this.
Mr. Buntrock, may I ask you a question?
Hey.
Is it your position that there was no safe way to move KM from Phoenix to Boston other than by air ambulance?
That is our position, and it's based on...
Is there any evidence of that?
Yeah, the three recommendations, Dr. Nutricia, Dr. Carey, and the other physician's name escapes me, but I have it here. It is Dr. Let's see if I can find his name. Dr. Richard Benning, who was a third-party administrator that Cerner engaged back in February of 17 to determine whether this flight from Phoenix to Boston was medically necessary. And this is in the record, ER 783 and 784. I believe it's cited in a brief, but it's excerpt of record volume 4. And I'll just quote from that doctor. He says, certified requested air transportation to Boston Children's Hospital, Boston MA from Phoenix AZ, as well as return trip. Medically necessary as the services this child needs are not available elsewhere and definitely not near Phoenix. He cannot be transferred by commercial air due to the constant dressing changes needed and TPN for this nutrition and hydration.
Why couldn't he be transported by commercial air because of the hourly change of dressings?
Yeah, because the commercial...
Why can't that be done in a commercial plane?
I'm sorry?
Why can't that be done in a commercial plane?
I believe that both the three doctors all concluded it wouldn't be possible to do it by commercial air transport because of the frequent need of dressing changes, needing of a sterile environment. And I'll get to the, I can read the record from Dr. Natricia at Boston and Dr. Carey at Phoenix Children's. Both of them said it wasn't medically appropriate for this 2-year-old young man with this very serious and we would suggest untreated, it's a life-threatening condition, that he had to go by medical air ambulance transport.
So if I'm understanding the record correctly, the flight was at one point estimated to cost $40,000, but eventually $600,000 were requested for the reimbursement. Can you explain what changed?
My understanding of the record, Judge Friedland, is that at the time of the, I believe through the what I've considered to be the pre-authorization process, and we would submit that really morphed into a claims process. But I believe that Cerner independently, I think it decided that this child needed the transport, and then it done some checking with some other providers to determine what the cost was, and that's where that number came. That number never came from United Air Ambulance, right?
Wait a minute. What number never came from United Air Ambulance?
The approximate $40,000 cost to fly the child. I don't believe that ever. I don't believe that United Air Ambulance ever submitted that, because oftentimes providers, you know, they don't want costs to determine whether a service is needed or necessary provided by the plan, right? And United Air Ambulance is an out-of-network provider. They're not an in-network NIDA provider to Cerner. And so I believe the record is that whatever estimate of cost came from Cerner doing some independent checking unrelated to...
You know, some of it doesn't quite make sense to me. That may be true, but I'm looking at what we have in the ER. A certain Tisha Clements of AHS writes to confirm or arrange air transport one-way priced by an unnamed carrier for $39,385. That may or may not have been United Air Ambulance, but if it's an air ambulance service for which the price, one-way price, is quoted as $40,000, it strikes me as very odd that the price all of a sudden becomes $600,000. I mean, there's just something that it's unexplained, and I don't understand it.
And I appreciate that, Judge Fletcher. I would respond a couple of ways. First, the issue isn't really about the price.
Well, it might be. I think if you had submitted a reimbursement request to Cerner for $40,000, they probably would have paid it. I mean, it's a lot cheaper to pay $40,000 than to go through this litigation process that they're now going through.
I don't disagree, but I think if we follow that supposition through, that to me demonstrates that there is an abuse of discretion here fundamentally, and that's one of the things we argue. Is that, as Judge Friedland pointed out, this pre-authorization process, I mean, even the defendants suggested it's not that relevant. We got to just look at the claim situation. But what I find interesting, in August of 2017, after Cerner has all the facts available to them, all the records, they know exactly what's going on as of March 21st. And what I find interesting is that their senior claims person, the person in charge of the determination of benefits here, says, and I'll quote her, she says, on the day of the transfer, we feel that the child would have met the criteria for a medical transfer given the fact that the child needed to be admitted to the hospital, we will approve this denial, which is kind of a double negative, but they previously denied it and then they reversed themselves. And then within, so that's on August 8th, with less than 30 days later, the claim is submitted. Then Cerner directs its third party to negotiate with United Air Ambulance to pay the claim. And there's a provider agreement issued to them and they accept it. And then after that, then they say, oh, no, time out. We're not going to pay the claim because now we're construing our plan to say that, well, there's no medical provider that said that the child should fly on March 21st, 2017. And that myopic view, we believe, demonstrates that this is a fundamental abuse of their discretion because they know full well there's three providers that have recommended this treatment in Boston. And it, you don't have to be a physician to determine that the only way he can receive that treatment and the only place he can get it is Boston. So he's got to get there somehow. Now, granted, I understand, and we're not here to suggest that insurance coverage is unlimited. But as the district court pointed out, when you start playing these interpretations and you're interpreting in a way to deny the claim, now you are playing with people's lives. And I don't mean to be over dramatic here, and it's not my intent. But you know, we come back to this. You had three physicians, and I agree, you don't just sit there and weigh, well, we have three that say yes, fly, and one that says don't. I don't think that's the argument. I mean, defendant wants to sit there and say, well, we were reasonable. We relied upon a doctor at the time of the flight. But you cannot ignore that it's undisputed that this child could not be treated. And I think
I think some of the things you're saying, I think we are not in dispute. But I want to come back to the $600,000 of the price paid. It may be in some way it may be irrelevant, but nonetheless, I'm puzzled by it. Are you prepared to represent to us that your client was not contacted ahead of time about what price they might pay?
I am confident to represent to the court only because. And I'll tell you why, because there's nothing in the record with price until they get to the claim submitted. The claim was submitted, I believe, on August 30th of 2017. And so the very first time there's any indication of price is August 30th when the claim was filed. So I'm confident and I know this client's efforts because at times when we're dealing with you know, whether to cover, make coverage decisions, right? We also want to start with the fundamental back to the premise of ERISA. The plan is there to protect the participant. And so not that cost can never be considered, but generally speaking, let's determine if the child needs the care here undisputed. Let's determine if the plan covers the care that's been recommended. In this case, it does. And then we got to pay the price, whatever that price is.
I've got another question that may not be directly relevant to the legal question in front of us, but it's a practical question. And that is, if we were to hold with Cerner on this point, who bears what cost? I mean, is the patient on the hook for $600,000? Or is your client going to eat it? What's going to happen?
Your Honor, what I can tell you is that, and I agree, it's not relevant for today, but to answer your question with respect to the court, I don't believe that my client is going to pursue, even though they legally could, would pursue this family for the unpaid claim. So if you uphold the district court's decision, which I believe this court should, then Cerner is going to pay the claim. There's already a judgment in favor of United Air Ambulance against Cerner. If the court does something other than that, then or if ultimately decided that the claim was correctly denied, then United Air Ambulance has, I guess, advanced the benefit for the past 4 years for which it doesn't get compensated. I mean, I think we're getting a little far, but I understand your question. And let me go back, if I can, with respect to...
Can I just ask, have you tried to mediate this case?
The parties did participate in the Court of Appeals kind of been called informal mediation process, where there was some effort made there by the parties, correct?
Do you think you've exhausted that, though? If we sent you back, would it be useful?
It may, Your Honor. I never want to foreclose, obviously, settlement, because I think, you know, if you can resolve it, it's always better for the parties. I would certainly have to consult with my client, but I, if that was a recommendation, I think my clients would participate in 100% participate in good faith.
Yeah, I mean, that might be a good idea. I can see weaknesses on both sides here.
If I may, and I don't know if I, in housekeeping, if I reserved a couple of minutes of time, and I appreciate you, Judge Fletcher, saying we'd have enough time. I, on the cross appeal, which is the attorney's fees, I don't need a lot of time there, but I reserve that.
I confess I'd forgotten about the cross appeal. You wish to speak to that now?
If I may, I want to be sensitive to the time. And so I have one other point I'd like to make on the main appeal, and then I would go to the cross appeal, if that's okay.
No, you fire away, please.
Oh, thank you. I guess what I wanted to emphasize, in addition to what that's set forth in the briefs about this plan, and the defendants in Cerner wants to say, hey, let's let the plan govern this, and we agree. And I think under the plan here, under just a this flight, it was a covered benefit of the plan, because the criteria of emergency, I guess, is a prerequisite. There's undisputed there was an emergency, right? But there's three situations where there's an air ambulance flight provided by the plan. One is it requires transport to a hospital. We have that. This young man, Cam, needed transport to a hospital. In this case, we're submitting it was Boston Children's, right? Secondly, the second time the air ambulance is provided is that you transport from one hospital to another when the first hospital does not have the required services to treat the participant. And I want to focus on that language. We set that forth in our brief, and that's the express language.
But that's all the easy part. The hard part is what's a medical emergency, which is the premise for this. Was the short bowel syndrome by itself a medical emergency?
Well, and I would submit to you with respect to ERISA, the obligation was to set forth what is the emergency. They never defined it. All throughout the process, 4.5 months worth, they never defined emergency. And they never give the opportunity for KM to provide the additional evidence for what is emergency, right? What's interesting is that...
I mean, he doesn't even seem to be relying on emergency anymore today, so...
Yeah.
You may have dropped out.
I mean, they've devolved to, well, I mean, it was, you know, on the claim side, wait a minute, no provider recommended the flight on the day that it happened. And again, there is nothing in the plan that says that it has to be, that there's some temporal limit to a provider's recommendation. I mean, common sense says to organize and coordinate with receiving hospital, the sending hospital, if that was the case, and the provider takes some time. It isn't just real time immediately. And under that, to argue, well, no provider recommended on that day. Well, that's true. They didn't recommend on that day, but there was three, and all the evidence suggests this young man needed this treatment. And
we get all that. Now, okay. You want to talk about the cross appeal now?
Yeah, I'll just briefly address that if I would.
Yeah, please.
And then I'll move on. With respect to the cross appeal, of course, the district court applied the Hummel factors, decided they were essentially even, and then said, well, we're going to deny the fees to UAA because, and we submit that the special circumstances weren't identified by the district court in denying the award of fees, because the general rule is that a prevailing party in an ERISA claim is entitled to their fees, and unless there's absent special circumstances that would make awarding those fees unjust. And there's no such finding from the district court about that special circumstance, and for those reasons, we think the district court erred in not awarding those fees.
Okay, good. Let's hear from the other side. Let's put 3 minutes on the clock for you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Answering your question about the pricing, it does absolutely make a difference, and here's why. The reason they were able to charge $600,000 is because they submitted this under the medical emergency situation where the providers don't need to be in network and there's no opportunity to negotiate that price. Cerner got quotes for that transport when they looked into it when the first medical opinions came in and it was $40,000, right? Then the patient presents with a medical emergency. The doctors say, this child should not travel. You should not take this child by air ambulance today. He's not stable.
No, wait a minute. No, wait a
minute.
And
they do anyway.
Excuse me. There's something funny going on. I don't understand. The air ambulance was arranged before the sepsis emergency shows up. The sepsis emergency threatens to interrupt with the flight that's already scheduled. Isn't that right?
No. No, Your Honor. There was no, they submitted a claim and it had been denied, but it hadn't gone through the administrative process. And
but
perhaps
the family
that was
had set up the flight at least. Wasn't that the whole point? That the mother had an understanding that if they didn't take the flight that day, they couldn't reschedule it for a long time or something because it had been set up for that day in advance.
No, I don't think that's the, I don't think those were the facts. They transported.
So you're saying that they called up air ambulance that morning?
That's correct, Your Honor.
That can't be. That's entirely inconsistent with what I read in the record where she says, listen, I'm worried that I can't reschedule this.
No, what I think she says is the February opinion, the Cerner plan comes out and says, we don't pay unless this is a medical emergency for air ambulance transport. Then the patient shows up at the emergency room and they say, well, here's an emergency. Let's transport this child. And the doctor says, no, you can't transport this child today because they have sepsis. They're not stable to travel. And they travel anyway.
That doesn't make any sense to me. And
where in the
record is this narrative that you're giving me?
That's what I took from those medical records. There's no evidence that there was a transport already set up. I've never heard that before.
Well, if there was none already set up, it doesn't make any sense that the mother is saying, I'm worried that I can't do this for a long time because I'm going to have to reschedule.
She's worried that the situation will stabilize and then it won't be an emergency anymore and she won't be able to take the flight.
Mr. Leopold, let me ask you a question. Mr. Buntrock talked about three medical doctors who said that it was an emergency that the child be transported to Boston in the ambulance. It's medically appropriate at that time. Doesn't that constitute a medical emergency?
No, Your Honor. In fact, what they said was that they said that the treatment was not available at Phoenix Children's Hospital and that he needed to be transported to Boston and that the best way to do that was via air ambulance. That is all correct. But they did not say that it was a medical emergency. Nowhere did they say.
So you are relying on the portion of the plan that provides for air ambulance only for a medical emergency?
That's correct, Your Honor.
In other words, Judge Friedland had it wrong that you conceded that point?
No. So there are two claims here. There was a claim based on those three medical opinions early in February, right? And those three doctors say they need to transfer to go to Boston. They file that claim gets denied, and then it gets dropped. There is no appeal of that claim. Then the child shows up at Phoenix Children's Hospital in the emergency room, and the decision is made that day to transport him to Boston because they say, aha, here's an emergency.
So I'm looking at ER 911, and it says that at least it was scheduled the day before, and it was before he woke up the next day feeling sick, which was the sepsis. At least on ER 911, it looks like that.
Hey, wait, where in that?
It's I'm in sorry. Number three, scheduled the day prior.
Okay, I stand corrected, Your Honor. I was not aware of that fact.
Yeah, well, that changes, that totally changes the narrative then. So she's not claiming, hey, I got an emergency and therefore today I want out of here. It was scheduled before the sepsis emergency arose.
That's correct. And now it was not going to be paid for by the plan because that claim had been denied.
Well, it was being appealed.
But you didn't have, I mean, today, I don't think we can go back on the whole 15 minutes we spent earlier. I had a whole list of questions for you about what the definition of emergency was, and you said you're not relying on that. So I mean, it's up to Judge Fletcher, but if you are relying on emergency, I have a whole list of questions for you, and I think you said you're not.
Well, there's no doubt that, I guess the important point is that there are two separate claims here, Your Honors. There is the claim in February for the underlying condition in which all those opinions were premised on he was stable and safe to travel.
Right. And that ends up in the pre-authorization, I'll use your terminology, even though it turns out as a post-event authorization. That ends up after the appeal approving it.
No.
August 8th, 2017.
No, Your Honor. That's not correct because what happens is that then he shows up with an emergency, right? And United Air Ambulance submits the pre-authorization request, the emergency pre-authorization request that day for...
I'm talking about something else. I'm talking about the pre-authorization request that begins February 20th, and then we finally get a resolution of the appeal on August 8th, 2017. That's what I'm talking about.
Right. That is a different request. That is not the request that was decided.
Well, that request was the resolution of that appeal was it was authorized, subject to the caveat, well, we may give you a different answer when you make a claim.
Correct.
But as I understand it, what was authorized then was we approve this as a, quote, pre-authorization, even though it's a post-authorization. We approve the pre-authorization of the payment for air transport for this patient, even though at this point they're not talking about sepsis. That's how I understand what the decision was on August 8, 2017 in the pre-authorization posture. What am I misunderstanding?
Well, I think that the important point is the pre-authorization request did not decide the claim.
No, I understand that, but is there anything that I just said that's wrong?
Well, there are two claims, and maybe we're just talking past each other here, and I apologize. But, you know, there's the February, the one that starts in February.
Right.
And then there's a new request, pre-authorization request, that is submitted the day that he shows up at the emergency room. The emergency room one is the one that goes through the pre-authorization process is decided on August 8th.
I thought your only argument was that there was a doctor recommendation against it. I think
that is correct because
that bowels and this bowel short bowel is not an emergency. That's not part of your argument as to the claim that we're talking about at this point, right?
That's correct because that claim, the second claim, stems from him being at the emergency room.
Right.
No one denies that that's an emergency. The claim regarding the short bowel syndrome just gets dropped. It never gets, it doesn't go anywhere, and it doesn't go through the administrative process. And
let me ask you one more question, Mr. Leopold, on that issue. How, other than by air ambulance, would you say that the parents could transport this child to Boston?
I don't know. And the only thing I can say to that is that if that first claim had gone through the administrative process, there may have been information brought forth about other ways to transport him, but it never went through the administrative process. We don't know what the answer to that is.
The doctors recommended that he use an air ambulance in February, right?
That's correct. Those doctors in February recommended it.
The burden is on Cerner now to say the child could have been transported by other than an air ambulance.
That's correct. But again, we're talking about two separate claims because the claim from February doesn't get appealed. Like, that's not before this court. They didn't exhaust administrative remedies. It was never decided. It was never examined. The request that gets appealed is the day when he shows up in the emergency room with sepsis and they transport him against medical advice. And on that day, no one's feeding.
We're way over time. So I'd just like to ask you if you think there would be any point of trying mediation again in this case.
I would never be opposed to mediation.
I would strongly recommend it because I think you're both going to lose.
I'll pass that on to my client for sure.
Okay. At this point, I'm not sure there's any point in further questions. Any further questions from the bench?
No.
Okay. Thank you very much. United Air Ambulance versus Cerner Corporation and the Health Exchange submitted for decision. Thank both of you.
Thank you, Your Honor.